Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Well, good evening. This is Terry Dodd, and this is Walls in Our Minds, and tonight we have a very special guest, Dr. Kate. Are you there? I want to let everyone know that we don't know for sure whether or not we're going to hear from Red Beckman this evening. He's got some family things going on this evening. He shared last week that his son has been diagnosed with a fairly advanced cancer, and they're battling that, and they've got a lot of family in town tonight. So if you're listening, Red, glad to have you with us, and feel free to jump in whenever you like. If not, we'll just proceed on.
And hi there. So, Terry, I just thought I'd let you know that I'm here.
Hello, Kate. How are you doing?
As best as I could be at this moment.
Okay.
How's that?
Well, we know you've been dealing with the passing of your mom for the last couple of months, and that's been a challenge, and I've been through that, and I certainly appreciate it, and I know many of our listeners have probably gone through that as well. We have area code 650 live. Is that you, Kirk?
It is. Good evening.
Well, welcome to Walls in Our Minds. Welcome back to Walls in Our Minds. It's been a while. You were on with us back at the beginning of the year, as I recall, and that was a great show. That was a great show, and we're looking forward to hearing an update on money, defending your prosperity, and also anything else that you'd like to discuss tonight. Very excited to have you. It's I don't know of too many people we've had on our show that I felt had a better grasp on the topic than you do, and I appreciate all the research that you've done, and I know that our listeners do as well. And I always open this show with a prayer, and if you guys don't mind, I'm going to give us a quick opening prayer. Gracious Father in heaven, we just want to thank you so much for this day. We thank you for the many ways that you've blessed us. We especially thank you for giving us forgiving hearts that we can have clarity and see the truth that's going on around us. Many of us have been praying that you show us the truth, and I think we didn't probably know, Father, just how scary the truth is. We're just thankful that you're there with us, walking with us all the way through this process, and that no matter what happens here on this earth or in this country, that the victory will ultimately be yours. And we just ask that your spirit be with us, and that you go before us tonight and bring forth the message that is in accordance with your will. And it's in your son Yeshua's name that we pray. Amen. Well, Kurt McKenzie, I'm just excited. I'm just going to be quiet for a minute and let you kind of give us an update of kind of what's gone on since you were last with us, and where you're at today, and are you writing, or you know, what are you doing?
Well, I'll tell you, I just organized probably probably one of the biggest events in the country here at the Grassroots. We had a huge event in Yreka, California. I became very interested in, you know, of course, property rights, water rights, what's going on in rural America, and I was kind of shocked by what I found out, so I was doing a documentary video, and we launched the documentary video, so we had an event where we had about 1,000 people. I launched the video, which is documenting the story of Siskiyou County, and then in addition, we had a panel of 8 sheriffs, all of whom stood up tall for the Constitution, and every single one of them got a standing ovation. And we had Karen Budfallen, came from Wyoming, to give her presentation. She did a phenomenal job talking about the Constitution. And we had a bus tour of people to from here in the Bay Area went up there and stayed overnight with the ranchers. We were welcome there, and then we took a tour of the dams. They're basically trying to take out four dams there and destroy what's little left of the economy. So that's pretty much what I've been doing for the past 2 months. I've been heavily engaged in that.
Well, I don't know if you know this or not, but Dr. Kate is a hydrogeologist.
I did not know that.
Well, now you do. did you see that new video that's out on those sheriffs from Northern California?
That was the event.
Dean Wilson, that you
yeah.
hosted that event?
Yeah, I'm the guy that organized that event.
Wow.
Yeah, there were actually
eight sheriffs
that night. Yeah, there was eight different counties represented, including John Lopi from Siskiyou County. Dean was there, as well as a number of others. I tried to get Sheriff back there, but he had some other engagement in Texas and couldn't get out of that. But, no, we had a phenomenal event. We had sheriffs from Northern California as well as Oregon, and we pulled together some 50 different organizations, all working cohesively together for the first time. And I would say that probably about a fourth to one-third of our guests were from outside of Siskiyou County, which is phenomenal, a good chunk of them from Oregon. So what's happening is that the attack really on these dams is being done on a kind of a regional basis where they kind of declare that the entire Klamath River Basin is what they're going to take jurisdiction over, which is an area larger than the state of Maryland. And so what's happening, they've been pretty much, the government agency has been pushing down on the individual counties and so forth. Well, now all of a sudden they've discovered they now have a regional response because we're getting together, we're unifying, we have a unified mailing list at this point in time. We are in real-time communication. And so this has never been done before. So this is pretty exciting.
Well, Kate, I'm going to let you get a couple of questions in here if you'd like. Because this is much more down your avenue, you should jump in and have a discussion on this one. She's usually muted, so it takes her a second to get unmuted.
This is very interesting. I think one of glad to hear you're doing that work, and there's been, you know, a pulling together, because I've had a long experience working for tribal water rights. And I've, within the last year and a half, really seen the light of what the tribes really represent to the federal governments, basically taking watersheds, taking whole watersheds. Because once you start with taking, you know, the basin, the watershed, then you take all the waters and the land use, because you then do water quality regulations. So to me, this is, and there is really nothing in the Constitution that allows that taking. But I note, just again as an aside, this is the way the feds use the tribes to basically take more and more and more. Because what I'm finding out is the whole, you know, reserving of tribal lands and reservations was not for the tribes. The real tribal people are dead. It's this new brand of folks that are out there. And I know this may sound blasphemous to some who may know of my work, but that land wasn't reserved for them. It was not. It was reserved so the feds could take it later. And that's exactly what's happening, for example, with the oil fields in North Dakota, which sit on one of the biggest reservations out there. So I'll stop right there and ask you to please explain more about how important this struggle is and how, you know, it relates to our finances and so forth and so on. I hope that's not too broad a question, but there you go. I hope that's okay, Terry.
Certainly.
Yeah, not at all. I'd be happy to do it. I think that the people in Siskiyou County who have been fighting this battle now for a number of years have interestingly realized, come to the realization, it's not about the science, it's not about the logic, it's not about what's right for the fish, you know, the coho salmon in this case. It's not about any of these things. They've come to realize that this really has to do more with Agenda 21 and the Wilderness Project. So they're kind of coming into that realization. But the question then is that I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, so I'm 6 hours away from Siskiyou County. So what the heck am I doing up there? And the answer is I happen to meet Jerry Bacigalupi and his wife, Donna Bacigalupi, who are ranchers down here in San Mateo, just a fortuitous meeting at a lunch that was being hosted by the Pellegrinis. And at that, I was talking about my philosophies, which is that we cannot work as separate entities. I was the California State Chair for the Ross Perot United We Stand America organization, and I know what a vertical organization works like. I know how it can be attacked and relatively easily. And so I kind of have that as a one model, and I realize that this grassroots effort we have now is a much more disjointed effort. We have a lot of independent, separate organizations, which I think is healthy because they are harder to attack. They have their own autonomy, their own budgets, their own things. They can nobody tell them what to do, when to do it, how to do it. They just go and blow. But what they're missing is that none of them have critical mass, and they don't aren't able to pull it off by themselves. So there has to be a synergistic way of working together, and I call that Communicate, Coordinate, and Cooperate, or C3 project. And so I was explaining my views to the Bacigalupis and also felt that I wanted to understand what was going on in their situation, and they began to explain their story. And as it happened, I was going to go up to the Red and Tea Party and make a presentation. They invited me to the ranch. I said, hey, I'd like to bring along my video camera if anybody wants to tell their stories on video. And darn if Jerry didn't arrange interviews with over 40 different people, PhDs and people who had prior experience in forestry and whatever else, and ranchers. And so what that kind of grew into was a documentary video, and which I have just released. And I also wanted other people from the Bay Area to engage in this because I feel that the urban people have to stand with the rural people. You know, our rural country is probably 95% of our land mass. It's that piece of land that the rest of us drive through from one city to the next. And frankly, that's really where our water, our food, our energy, our building materials, you know, basically our national security come from. And so I wanted to engage. They wanted to engage. We got this tour up there. The bus tour grew. It became a big event. I invited the sheriffs. We managed to pull that off, and Sheriff Lopi was pivotal in getting the rest of them. And so it just kept getting bigger and bigger. We unified organizations. All the things that I've been trying to do, we're actually beginning to do. But I think it's important for most of Americans to understand that the U.S. Treasury is now the U.S. debtory. I mean, it's completely misnamed. There's no gold in Fort Knox. And our real treasury is our land and our natural resources. And if you travel out to these farms and the ranches, you become well aware that these people love the land. They love what they do. They're providing a critical job. They're the true stewards of the land. And they're being strangled to death by federal agents wearing uniforms that never pick up a plow or a hoe or a shovel, telling them what to do, how to do it, when to do it. Here's the permission to do it. These people don't take care of the land. But the people that do are under unbelievable duress now, and they're being pushed by illogical, unscientific, and fraudulent arguments to give up their lands or their forests or their jobs. And so I decided to engage the battle. It's just we need to draw a line in the sand and say no more.
Well, it's one of the things I wanted to get into with you tonight, Kurt, was maybe some of the peripherals that you know, when you start researching money and the banks, it kind of leads into everything else that's going on. And that being the core of it really puts you in a position to see just how their tentacles reach into every facet of our lives. And in our previous discussion, we kind of stayed focused on the money issues, sound money, banking, you know, how they've basically been ripping us off and going after our rights in that way. But there's got to be a lot more, and this is a perfect example of that for me, because it's all tied together, and it all leads back to the same place. And I'm wondering if maybe you can talk about maybe some of the surprises that you've encountered in this research and where how this has taken you to where you are now. What some of the surprises were that have hit you in that research?
Well, you know, I since I ran the organization, I continued my research. I started a long process. I have an engineering degree background. I have an MBA background. I'm a pretty detailed kind of guy. And when I dig in, I really dig in. And so I have really understood the world in a way I think very, very few people understand. I have a true depth and breadth of understanding of this. And I don't care what path you start down, and I've been there, you name it, whether you want to talk about secret societies, you want to talk about money, you want to talk about sovereignty, illegal immigration, education, all the things that are concerning our country, our culture, the cultural decline. You eventually come to the realization that these are not separate events and issues, that they all come back to a common hub. And that hub, frankly, in the United States is in New York City, and it's a group of international banking families. And they have a radically different vision of the world for us in the future. I mean radically different. And in that world, they are gods. We are essentially cattle. I'm being pretty frank because this is exactly how they view it. It took me 20 years to come to this kind of realization, so others probably won't understand that right away or feel like that's nuts, but there it is. And they want a radical reduction in the population. They want to push the people off the land and huddle them into little communes that are concrete, stack-and-pack communes under Agenda 21. And control every aspect of our lives, take away our transportation, our vehicles, you know, have us walk and bike to work, which is, you know, a few blocks away, take away all of our freedom of choice. I mean, it is a radical difference. And so I put out a video called How to Take Our Country Back because I felt, based upon my experience, that the grassroots organizations were not succeeding. They were going in the wrong direction. They were defocused. They were all over the map. They didn't really truly understand the world. And so my money series evolved into a dialogue I was having with the grassroots organizations out there. And now that video has had some 32,000 hits on YouTube and continues to grow at the rate of about 1,000 a week or so. And in there I'm talking about you better understand the world because we have hundreds of issues out there, but you need to understand what issues really count. And stop chasing everything. Stop being on the defense. You need to understand where to go on the offense. And those are things that you don't even know are issues that came and went a long time ago. And at the foundation of that power that they have is their control of the monetary system. And part of that is, so I lay out five or six different offensive things that we must accomplish. Then I lay out five defensive ones. And one of those is that we have to defend ourselves against the private property attacks on the Agenda 21. So the whole thing in Siskiyou County fits within that model, and here comes an example, not quite in my backyard, but an example of what I've been talking about, and which is going across nationally, and I figured we'd draw the line in the sand here. We win. We set the model. We transport or export that to groups all across this country and begin to define how we're going to succeed and get our country back.
Well, I'd welcome you to elaborate a little more on that because one of the – Kate and I both, and especially Red, if he's listening, we tend to focus on solutions. You know, Kate has been very focused on the eligibility question, you know, the fact that they're not following the Constitution on the natural-born citizen issue. And I don't believe that this president is even the second one. I think he's probably the fourth that hasn't complied with the Constitution. But the point is that we try to focus on solutions. I look very strongly at sound money as being kind of a gateway to making any progress on any of the other grievances. In other words, I don't believe we can get redress until we have proprietary ownership of our money because that's how they've created this banking vortex, which you understand about as well as anybody I know, on how they basically siphon off our production, and they do that because we don't have proprietary ownership of our own money, and they set up the whole Federal Reserve system, which you've done extensive work on, and I really appreciate your videos on it because it really makes it so that the average person, you know, Joe Sixpack, whatever you want to call the, you know, some people say you have to talk to a fourth grade education to get to the average person. You do a really good job of laying that out. But point is that we're in an ambush, and it's a very, very broad ambush. and we've got to figure out how to back out of it. So my question to you is, if we spent the rest of the next hour and a half talking just about how we can back out of this ambush, I'd be a happy camper.
Well, I'd be happy to do that. There's multiple layers to this. So part of it is, this is also explained in How to Take Our Country Back, Part 1, which is a strategic view, is first off, we have to understand the world. I mean, you know, I have come to the conclusion and the realization that the rarest commodity there is to understand the truth in your own time. You know, we look back at history and we see all the intrigue and the families poisoning each other and wars that were really having to do with egos of certain individuals, et cetera, and we somehow think that we're now in a modern age and all that doesn't apply, but it does. And so the first thing you have to start with is the truth, and there's darn few people that really understand it. I can count, well, in fact, I'm not even sure I can count fingers on one hand that understand it in the way that I understand this. So you have to understand the truth. Number two is, once you understand the truth, those of us who know it have to put together what I call a toolkit. And that is the best book. You have to put the best YouTube videos, best articles, best links, you know, no pride of authorship. You go find out the best of the best, and you help people find that stuff. But there has to be an on-ramp. I mean, you can't just jump them in and expect them to be talking, you know, in depth about these things when it's so foreign to what they understand. So there has to be a way to bring them into a topic. And I've learned that you can't do it in a five-minute conversation, even with a family member. It just doesn't work. So that's where I started with the book, which is heavily, heavily illustrated. It's a layout where the left page is the text. That's for the left brain people. And the right page is an illustration, which is for the right brain people. That led into my seminars, which then led into my YouTube series, Money, How to Defend, Why We're in So Much Debt. So those of us who understand have an obligation to take our knowledge and put it into a digestible format and assemble the toolkit. Once we have that toolkit, then we have to build an infrastructure whereby we can communicate. We have to forget about television. We have to forget about the mainstream radio, the magazines. They're all controlled. We have to build a Citizens Newswire. So I actually have a thing called Citizens Newswire, and we have to continually and perpetually increase the number of people that we can reach and be able to communicate and influence their opinions without depending upon television. And I have a strategy on how to do that and way we're linking people up to do that, and they need to help to get that thing to do. Once you have that in place, you have the basis now to build an organizational synergy where you have the ability to actually truly have communication, coordination, and cooperation. And once you have that, now you're ready to go ahead and understand the tactics of how you win this war. And some of these are down and dirty, Saul Alinsky type of things, but you have to understand the opposition. You have to understand what parts of that you can use and not violate your moral principles, but still use. And so that's How to Take Our Country Back, Part 2, which is a tactical element of that. And then you have to then be able to move forward on that strategy and with those tactics towards a defined end goal. And in there, you have to understand your moral bearing. You must understand your moral bearing, where it comes from, where it leads to, where you're in on that map. And that's also part of How to Take Your Country Back, Part 2. I lay out a whole complete philosophy of where our values came from, what those values are in simple terms, how those values are in competition with a different set of values. So I think that there's a multiple level answer to your question, how do you win? It's not just that you have a solution to the monetary system, which, you know, in my book, you know, I talk about, which I, in my opinion, legal tender notes are going to be part of that. I think every idea should come onto the table. But I happen to believe that we're not going to be able to jump back to gold and silver the way that people think that you do. I think we have to unwind ourselves the way that we got into this, and I think that's why we have to understand history so critically, to understand who's behind this, how they did this, and how we unwind it, and then you can do this. And so I do agree with you, and the reason I wrote a book on probably the most least read topic in the world, which is the monetary system, the reason I did that, because ultimately we have to take the power of the financial systems away from these people, because it's what gives them the power to do everything they do. It's how they fund the world government. It's how they fund the attack on our culture. It's how they fund television. It's how they they fund all these green groups and actually create these green groups. It's how they attack our culture, our religion, you know, basically when you can print money out of thin air and it's debt monetized currency that can only go issued if somebody goes into debt, and that creates a perpetual bondage through this indebtedness, you know, you eventually realize we don't win until we take away the power of money. But in the meantime, you have to be able to defend other issues. So that's all part of that strategy. So I can talk to you about this at all kinds of layers, but we have to understand all of those layers because we have to have our own infrastructure for success in order to succeed on anything we do.
Well, most of our listeners, Kurt, are fairly advanced in their understanding of where the problem lies. And we've done a lot of, spent a lot of time educating people here at Walls in Our Minds and on Revolution Radio about this type of subject. And so I believe that you can feel free to kind of give an advanced course, if you will. I don't believe you have to be worried that they're not with you or they're not following you. I believe this group of listeners is very far along down this path. But they all want to know what they personally need to do to make a difference. And your Citizen Newswire thing, and I appreciate it. I get an awful lot of that sort of thing, so it's difficult for me to spend a lot of time on emails when they come in, but yours is loaded with good stuff. And maybe that's a place to start, because we've got to get to a position where the people who are aware, who are somewhat awake, if not fully awake, can communicate and get some kind of coordination. I'm not suggesting that we all fall under one umbrella, because I believe that's dangerous. But we do need a common means of communication. So maybe that's a place to start.
And I actually have a strategy in place, and I've been implementing that for 2 years. So you're absolutely correct. And so the way I envision this thing going forward is that we have to manage or continue to have the strength of the autonomy of these individual groups, because it's kind of like, the way we defeated Britain was not with a regular army, but with guerrilla warfare. And I think it has that kind of guerrilla warfare aspect to it. So we have to maintain the vitality of that and the ability for people to respect their desires and what they want to do. At the same time, the people who are leaders and responsible need to understand the essential need to be able to work together with other groups. And so the communication part of this is critical. And it has to be done in a way that accomplishes both purposes, a global communication system or a national communication system. At the same time, the individual organizations continue to have their own autonomous communications. I can't get too far into the details of that, but that is being put together. And I am unifying communications in Idaho, California, Oregon, multiple states. And that communication is occurring not on a geographic basis, but on a per-issue basis.
Are you relying on the Internet or using alternatives?
Well, I think we have no choice but the Internet at this point in time. I mean, when I was with United We Stand America, we didn't have – the Internet was just coming out. In fact, I remember talking about, when the first browser came out, what do we do with the thing? And what we were relying on at that point in time was fax trees and phone call trees. And let me tell you, I know what that's like. So – what most people don't realize is the value of what's in front of us in terms of plumbing the full resources of the Internet to do email, to do websites, to do Facebook accounts, Twitter accounts, YouTube videos. We have to apply all those tools in a unified fashion to accomplish our ends. And so, for example, Defend Rural America, which is the campaign that I have put together for that purpose. We do have a Defend Rural America website, which is currently going through a facelift, so we'll be back up a couple of days. We have a Defend Rural America YouTube channel. We have a Defend Rural America Facebook page. We have a Defend Rural America Twitter account, so forth. So that's part and parcel to that. We also have a Defend Rural America email forum where literally thousands of people can communicate in a roundtable fashion. And we only hook together the people who are activists. We don't hook together, general public. So we're looking for people who are engaged in these fights. They already understand the issues. So this isn't the on-ramp. This is the people who are already there wanting to do stuff, wanting to implement their strategies. We got them hooked up. And it's a mighty thing to to see when you start seeing that people are working together in a cohesive fashion on a real-time basis, yet they still have the vitality of their individual organization. So if my website, if Defend Rural America were up at the moment, you'd be able to see the Twitter feeds I was fleeting. You see this long, long list that goes on like three different computer screens to see all the organizations that got behind our October 22nd launch.
Well, you're obviously aware that they use a lot of these social sites, social networking sites, as data farms. How do we take advantage of that at the same time protect ourselves?
My email does not go through any of those. So I've developed my own email network, and we protect the privacy of people to the maximum. I don't know Google. Yeah, Google is sitting there and analyzing everything you do. They're doing, I know how they do it. I know the technology behind it. They're analyzing everything that you do. They're profiling you. They're figuring out who you communicate with, when you communicate with, what kind of things you're communicating on. And they're profiling you. The police are profiling you. You know, I think Yahoo to a lesser extent, but Google is the number one culprit. I do not use Google. I don't have a Google Mail account for myself, and I don't use Google Mail to hook people together.
Me either. But you talked about Twitter. You talked about Facebook. They're using them too.
Yeah, and you can't unfortunately get around the internet, and so it has its blemishes. But you know, as you know, we're at a point where it's now or never, and so we have to fully realize the power of the tools that are in front of us and use them as best we can. To put people together. I mean, it's a race. I mean, there's no question there's a race between their trying to establish a police state and monitor us and profile us via the internet at the same time that we're just now beginning to wake up as a people and understand that there really are problems here and beginning to hook people up. There's no question. There is a race. And one side's going to win and one side's going to lose.
We've got a question about if you have a DVD out yet about defending the Klamath Dams.
I do. I just actually finished it yesterday morning. In fact, I've been kind of slow on the DVD thing anyway. I pretty much went from my book to the seminars to YouTube videos, and then I thought free YouTube was enough, but I'm realizing a lot of people like DVDs. So my stuff is now either on YouTube or you can go to my website, which is silentnomorepublications.com, silentnomorepublications.com. And just yesterday I put up, now I have a DVD, I have the book on money, I have a pocketbook called Follow the Money. I have a DVD on the Siskiyou County event, and the video, the documentary film that I developed of that, which is the people telling their own story. I also have combined all three seminar series in the Why We Earn So Much Debt into a single DVD, and I've combined both parts of How to Take Our Country Back into a DVD. So there's a small but very profound and I think very informative and mind-provoking series of information contained in those. I've worked a long and hard time on those, and I do believe that they change people's minds, and I do believe that they serve the function of an on-ramp to get you into a topic and then to develop the depth of the topic to whatever level people want to go.
Publications has an S on the end of it?
Yes, it does. So it's Silent No More. It kind of reflects the decision that my wife and I made a couple years ago. Silent No More Publications, plural.com.
Do you have a specific group of politicians that are involved in pushing for the dams to be removed?
We have actually worked the other way around. We have a specific set of politicians that are working to save the dams. So this is now being engaged at the political level. If there's somebody that's not supporting the people, then the plan will be we will remove them. We're not going to wait for elections. Time is too short. So in this particular case, we're fortunate in that the county commissioners are all behind this. As far as we can tell, those who are not will be removed. It's just that simple, and the same approach to the sheriff. So it's kind of one of the interesting parts about the presentation. We invited all the sheriffs in the counties that were in the Klamath Basin and more, And it was interesting. We got 8, which was pretty phenomenal, but there were some that we invited that didn't come. I almost thought about mentioning it at the meeting, and then I decided the better of it. I thought, no, let's just build on the one we have. But what's interesting to watch is the follow-on dialogue coming from people who were there saying, hey, how come my sheriff wasn't at the meeting? And I think that people need to, you know, we've been pretty much a Christian nation. We've been pretty much a nice people. Those days are gone. The other side's been taking some pretty brutal tactics. I think we have to engage and we have to get serious. And if people in office, you're either for us or you're against us. You know, I'm bringing back some of the rhetoric of the 60s, you know, when the blacks or the were having their deal. I think we have to adopt some of that because I believe that people are. And, you know, you lead, follow, or get out of the way. It's that time. So, this is actually has a political element to it. That's definitely part of this. We have to make sure that we have honest elections and that we have voter integrity. So there's people who are focusing on that issue. I happen to believe that we should eliminate D-bold machines from all the election process across this entire country and that we should get the machines out because they're nothing but banker terminals. And those need to be removed or we won't have honest elections. We need in California to completely overhaul a system that allows people to vote without any driver's license or voter identification whatsoever, and the fraud that's occurring with the mail-order ballots. I mean, there are people and great people here in the Bay Area and elsewhere that are beginning to dig into the details of these kinds of things and beginning to expose this and work on it in the areas in which they have some authority. So they're developing their fuel kits, and so we work together to make sure that those kinds of materials get out to the world. Fred Kelly Grant, who works on coordination, for example, gave an excellent presentation of the Reading Tea Party. They have a great video of that. I direct people to that video all the time. People working on Agenda 21, you know, we direct people to those websites. I mean, that's we incorporate their materials and help to get that word out. So that's the kind of cooperative effort we need to have these days.
Well, we've got listeners who would like to know what politicians need to hear from them. So if you've got, you know, a few that you could mention that our listeners could write to or call, or especially at the federal level, because I'm assuming that this is being pushed from the federal
level. Federal and state. But, you know, for example, Tom McClintock here in California is emerging as one of the spokespeople for the rural Americans, and he's beginning to pick up that banner. I believe this is inherently one that Rand Paul and Ron Paul, who I have tremendous respect for, would be on board in a minute if they knew about it. So I'm making that communication directly. That will occur. So I think those kind of people are definitely there. And I think it's time to put this kind of information in front of the people who would like to be president. And we're going to do that. And we're going to have people follow up with their offices and find out whether or not these people go forward. And if they don't put it and start getting on the bandwagon and making public hay, then we're not going to vote for them. And we'll organize against them. I mean, that's where we have to be these days. So politicians, beware. I mean, we're not going to just sit back and take your nonsense anymore. We're going to take our country back. So
We're looking for some names of the politicians who are behind the nonsense. In other words, who do we need to contact and tell them stop?
I actually think that there's something else we need to do. I think that we have fundamentally made a mistake. I think that a lot of grassroots organizations spend a lot of time faxing Barbara Boxer, for example, and Dianne Feinstein, and they're still in the belief that this is a debate or an honest discussion between Americans. It's not. It's a different between visions of the future, and you're wasting your time. Instead, I think you go find the politicians who are with us, and you figure out how to support them, and you figure out how to, you know, if you have a politician that supports you, you figure out how to get them campaign funds. You help, you know, if they have a newsletter, you help to get them subscribers so they have a bigger voice. If they do something right, you send a petition in support. Forget the petitions against or all these, you know, you didn't do this right. That's a waste of time. It really is a waste of time. I think we have to find the people who are fighting on our side and get behind them and stand with them. And that's what we're doing with the sheriffs.
What about environmental organizations that are really the strongest ones pushing the dam removals?
we need to expose that, not only the organizations, but the names of the individuals that are behind these organizations, because there's fraudulent science going on here, and I think we ought to need to start looking at legal action against people who are issuing fraudulent science. In this particular case, some of the most radical environmental groups are coming out of Portland, Oregon. You know, I think that Dr. Kate would probably know and jump in a moment's notice that most of these people are trying to dictate the control of land they don't even live on, you know, and quite often across the country. So in a particular case here, we have organized groups coming from Portland, Oregon, and I know they're coming down to the San Francisco Bay Area in terms of the visioning process going on here as well. A large part of that's coming out of there. And, you know, the money for that, no doubt, comes from people like George Soros. So, you know, we have to get smart on that kind of stuff. But, you know, I don't want to know into names at this point in time, but you definitely have to identify these people, get back to the core, and go after them and start to expose them. It's, you know, and we'll be doing that. There'll be a series of exposés.
Have these sheriffs talked about working through grand juries to go after some of these people, like Georgie Schwartz? George Soros is a name he goes by. But, you know, we've got people like that that are truly committing criminal acts. And we have totally lost control of our grand juries, and it seems like the sheriffs may be in the best position to help restore true runaway, which is a good word for grand juries. Have you heard any discussion out of those sheriffs about that?
No, but I'll tell you what. If you want to pull together a radio show and on that, and you'd like to bring in some experts on the grand jury, I'll get you some sheriffs, and we'll put them on your show. And we'll have a very interesting dialogue. And that, I think those are the kinds of ideas. We also have, you know, other legal principles. You know, the coordination is one of those, for example. I think we need to take a look at fraudulent information is another. I mean, so if you'd like to help to organize things to talk about, develop the legal aspects of this, I'll be happy to supply you with guests.
We're definitely interested in that and would be glad to promote it in a big way. And I would be honored to participate with you on that. And I know Kate and Red Beckman would too.
Yeah, well, you pull together the people. You know, I think from this side we'll be bringing the knowledge of our particular situation, but not necessarily a full understanding of everything we can do with grand juries. So you bring the guests in on that side of the equation. I think we'll put them together, and I guarantee you that'll be integrated into the process, because I think you're right. I think that's a powerful tool.
Are you familiar with Elo Jones with the Fully Informed Jury Association?
No, I'm not.
We work very closely with Elo, and Red Beckman was probably the inspiration for that organization being created.
Okay.
So it would be great to pull them into to that process.
Well, let's do it.
Let's do it. Okay, now, we talked about communication. What's the next thing we need to do to back our way out of this ambush?
Well, so people in your audience, first off, so you need to follow the sequence, you really do. So first off, you need to understand the truth. And so I encourage everybody, go to my website, Silent No More Publications, or go to my YouTube channel, which is Silent No More Pubs. Actually, go to the YouTube channel, Silent No More Pubs, and turn off the TV for 1 week. And 1 hour every night, I want you to watch one segment of one of my deals. And then I think you're going to have an epiphany. and by the time you're done with that, you're going to understand who's behind this, what it's going to take to unwind it. You'll understand what kind of level of detail these battles are going in, and you're going to come back with a very crisp understanding of the strategy and the tactics to be employed. I think everybody should do that. And those were assembled with for a reason, and they are profound. If you question that, just go to the YouTube videos and look at the comments that people have made on those videos. And, you know, thumbs up. I think there's like 800 thumbs up now on how to defend our country. And the comments are tremendously positive because people are discovering them. I think I had 400 views just today. It's kind of interesting. It's not a viral thing like sex or some cute, clever joke thing, but it's definitely moving forward. So that's, I think, the place that everybody should start. Second, if they want to hook in, Those who are really truly activists on these kind of rural issues, and by those I'm talking about water rights, property rights, principally in rural areas, you know, going after, you know, the Endangered Species Act, the tribes, you know, whatever they're doing to try and take over these things. If you're an activist, you're engaged in this fight, you've either fought one and you lost, or you're currently in fight, or you know you're coming up with a fight, or the dam in your area is about to come out, hook up. I'll put you on the, we have a call to DRA, the Defend Rural America mail form. You can join the conversation. That's another thing you do. So you just email me and let me know you have an interest. My email address is, you can either hit me at kirk@silentnomorepublications.com or kirk@defendruralamerica.com. Either one will get to me.
Okay. Next. Once they've done that, what's the first thing they need to do next?
Well, once you understand that stuff on an individual basis, then I encourage everybody to get everybody else to understand that stuff. So the biggest thing you can do is help to get the word out. I actually have training sessions here I give on how to maximize the views on a YouTube video. But people should try and get as many of their, if they belong to a group, they ought to learn how to embed a YouTube video in their message boards. If they have a group website, they ought to put a link on it back to mine or anybody else's that you feel is excellent. They should start to send it out to their email list. They should put it on their Facebook accounts. They should Twitter it to their friends. In other words, they need to be part of the communication team. They need to be part of the multiplier, because once those who understand the truth have put together the toolkit, now it's somebody else's job to make sure that you get it out to the millions of people that we need to get it out to. If they do nothing more than to, you know, expand the word, we will win. We don't need, you know, there's only a certain amount of the rule. When it gets down to what's really, really important, there's not a whole lot of it, to be bottom line. Now, once you get a few core things, you got it. So the rest of it is communication, getting more and more and more and constantly more people aware of the issue. At the same time, you move your efforts up to the implementation phase, which is where the strategy and the tactics comes from, and the unification across organizations, all of which I have that framework in place. And you get into elections, you know, there's implementation details of elections and how you go about doing that and how to run a meeting and, you know, how to support your representatives and how to attend a meeting and defeat, the Delphi technique and so forth. I mean, all that's packaged in there.
You know, a lot of us here are true constitutionalist. How do you feel about at this point standing on the Constitution? Is that critical at this point?
I do believe the Constitution is important. I think understanding it is extremely important. I think all of us that have a desire to get back to a constitutional government, and more importantly, not even the Constitution as much as the principles. You know, they like to define us as a nation of laws. No, we're not a nation of laws. We're a nation of principles. And one of those is individual rights. It's liberty, individualism. You know, we need to get back to our core values. But the the Constitution, we need to understand it, both its positives and its negatives. We need to understand, I think, particularly the Civil War period and exactly how it got, with the polite word I want to use, corrupted during that period of time with the 13th Amendment leading into the 14th Amendment. We need to know the 16th, the 17th. We need to understand those. I do believe that the Constitution is an important part of this. And the various theories about, you know, is the U.S. government a corporation and the straw man, I'm familiar with all this stuff. People who have those kind of viewpoints, the missing ingredient is a clear, concise white paper, 6 to 8 pages long, that outlines your arguments in favor of that with a few cites to Supreme Court cases, not too much detail, but a few quotes to get so you have a cogent argument put together that people can then go back and track. I have talked to many, many experts in these areas and have yet to find one that can fairly concisely defend some of those arguments. I do have my own views on some of the stuff I do believe is real. I think that the argument that the District of Columbia became a corporation and adopted the U.S. Constitution as its, bylaws or whatever, I'm not sure I'm on board that. I haven't seen the proof of that. But I do believe that the 13th and the 14th Amendments, and particularly the 5th and 6th clauses of the 14th Amendment, for example, are fundamental to understanding what's happened here. So I am a big, big believer in the constitutional aspects of this, and I actually started a team to have a discussion on constitutional things.
Do you believe it's possible that we can get Ron Paul elected?
I tell you, the biggest disturbing factor to me is I talk to people all day long, and I have a pretty big newsletter list. And one time a few months ago, I put out a question, and I didn't prompt people with the answers. I just, who do you most trust for president? And the results from the list were kind of interesting. Number one on that list by far was Rand Paul. 40% of my list said Rand Paul, and Ron Paul was 32%, and then the next one was probably around 12%. I mean, they are by... in a way, the most trusted people there are. I wish that Ron were a more eloquent spokesperson, but I actually believe he is our best choice for president and that he really is a true populist and he truly does understand the problems that we face, and I am on board with him. So the limitation that I find is that when you talk to people, even ones that understand the monetary system, you say, who are you going to vote for? Well, gosh, if I thought he could win, I'd vote for Ron, but I just don't think he's going to win. It's the same thing that happened with the Ross Perot election. It's people believing that you couldn't, third-party candidate couldn't win it, and it becomes self-fulfilling prophecy. I think if people got away from that and adopt the philosophy of vote for the person who will actually get us back on the constitutional path, we'd end up voting in Ron Paul.
Well, we share your feelings on that, and I know we've had a number of conversations about his, I don't know if I would call it eloquence as much as I would say his ability to clearly convey his message at times seems to be lacking. But I recognize also that when he's given opportunity, when he's given the time to explain himself, he does a pretty good job of that. Who do you think would be a good VP for Ron Paul?
Rand Paul. No, I'd actually make him Attorney General. Oh, who would I like for Vice President?
I really like Tom Woods, but
uh-huh.
I've met Tom and I've listened to him speak, face to face, and I've heard his, talk about, that he's a teacher, and that's really where he feels comfortable. And so I've kind of given up on thinking that, he should be pushed into a VP position or something like that, because I just don't think he's comfortable wearing that political hat yet. Maybe he'll get there, but right now I don't believe he's very comfortable doing that.
Well, I'll tell you, names that I pick actually will surprise you, because they're probably on nobody's radar and have no chance. But people I've met personally 20 years ago, people of integrity, I know they have integrity, and I've been watching them, and they don't always agree with my solutions, but they are people of character. John Kasich, who was in Congress, who was the one that led the parade to get the budget balanced and is now governor of Ohio. Senator Jim Inhofe, who was the one that went out when they went to Copenhagen to so-called agree to this cap and trade deal, was the one that went on his own dime to go out there and say, no, the President of the United States and his entourage of 110 people or whatever, no, they don't speak for the United States. You cannot have a treaty without Senate approval. He was the one that did that. He is a person of character. I would look for people of character.
Totally. And Inhofe is on my short list as well.
Yeah, I think both of those, and they're both politically savvy. They've been around a long time, and I think they're in the right, right place.
Well, we've got about an hour left here, and I'm just wondering what you believe would be the most effective topic for you to talk about that this group of listeners would benefit from.
Well, if you want to talk about details of financial system, I'm happy to talk about that. If you want to talk about details of constitutional, these constitutional amendments, we can talk about that. You probably know your audience better than I. If you want to talk about more in-depth things about what's going on in rural America and some of the examples of what's happening, I'd be happy to talk about that.
Let's start there. Because that's a topic we haven't really spent much time talking about, and I think that would be good. I'll let you have the floor.
Rural America?
Yes.
Okay, well, let's I'll give you some of the education I've been getting over the last couple of months. And, you know, it was shocking. I was born in Idaho, and although I never really lived there much, I lived mostly in urban areas as my dad was restationed from one place to another as part of the Air Force. I've been in and out of Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, Oregon, Washington, you know, my entire life, and probably pretty rural in my terms of my values and the way I think. And so, but I had no idea. The first thing that I think I understand is almost a complete blackout of what goes on in the 95% of our country. I mean, when was the last time you saw a TV show that was stationed in Kansas City or Pocatello, Idaho, or Phoenix, Arizona, or Albuquerque, New Mexico, you know, someplace in Tennessee? It's almost all television today is not only, it's all broadcast in New York City, but most of the shows are actually based in New York City. That's particularly true since 9/11. So there needs to be more understanding there, but there's a complete blackout. So the public has to reach out to understand what's going on there, and hopefully your show will help to do that. So here are some of the things that people face. An agent, a special agent of NOAA. NOAA is National Oceanographic Something Agency. They're responsible for fish in the ocean. One of these agents shows up on a ranch, nearly 200 miles, river miles, away from the ocean, shows up on a guy's property, claiming that his responsibility for fish in the ocean gives him authority for what's going on 200 miles inland on his rancher's property, demands access to the rancher's property, and then the rancher says no. And this guy, the special agent, by the way, special means that they carry guns and bulletproof vests. When this guy said no, the agent basically said, I have the right to come onto your property whenever I want. I don't need a search warrant. I don't need any access, and I can knock down your gate to get in. And then proceeds to read the rancher his Miranda rights. That's happening. Up in Oregon, on the federal national lands, these forests, they have taken a policy. They will not let mankind in there to do anything with the trees. So what's happening is the trees, rather than being harvested and thinned out, are getting to be very dense, so that when they do burn, they burn very hot. They burn up into the canopy, and these are why we're getting these wild fires that just seem to be unstoppable. So whereas the trees might, you know, I forget the numbers are, the density of trees would be normally, with a certain amount of harvesting, would be a kind of a, say, 100 or whatever. You know, the density might be 500 trees in the same space. So the density is getting to be extremely high. They let the dead trees fall away on the ground, and so forth. And they were prohibiting these people from doing anything with any of that lumber. They won't even let them come in and take out the dead trees and cut them up for firewood. And so up in Oregon, they've taken the policy. There was an agent there of the Forest Service, a woman, who there was a guy driving a pickup truck that had a couple of logs in the back, or, you know, pieces of wood to weight down the back of a pickup truck for traction. If anybody's ever driven a pickup truck, you know you need to have a bag of concrete or something heavy in the back to give enough weight over the back tires so they actually don't spin out, but they actually have traction. And she stops him and pulls out a gun. And at gunpoint tells this guy that he's violating the law by cutting down, you know, or cutting wood in the forest. This is the kind of behavior that they are facing. They are illegally, and this is acknowledged even by retired forest people, they won't name themselves, but they acknowledge this fact, they are illegally taking the roads that go into the public lands and putting fences and gates across them, chaining them off, illegally, knowingly, to force keep everybody off land, trying to return these to the true wilderness areas where people have no access whatsoever. And if they, you know, people try and go across this, then they start to arrest them or threaten them, pull out the guns. This is going on. The federal government is declaring more and more of our lands monuments. Now, a monument, you know, I tend to think of as a statue. But these are actually, a monument can be millions of acres of land, and the federal government declares it to be a monument. That means no people. They shut off all access to a monument and no people, nothing. No hunters, no fishermen, no people living, you know, unless they happen to be, live in the private land happens to be in there, or somebody has a right, the only thing that might be captured inside of one of those monuments, they shut it off. Now, one woman who got captured inside of a monument, her home was inside the monument. These people put a gate across the road that led to her home. And these people only work Monday through Friday, you know, till 5 o'clock. Well, this woman wanted to come home after 5 o'clock on a Friday, and the gate was shut, and she couldn't get into her home. She could not drive into her home until Monday. And so she now is afraid to leave the home, or can only travel during the working hours of the forest people. And what the forest people come and do is change the locks periodically on this woman. They give her a key, but then they change the lock a little later. So she has this perpetual problem. So now she is essentially a prisoner in her own home, afraid of, you know, when she can travel outside of her home. They're taking the water. You know, when they take out the dams, when you eliminate a dam has cheap electricity. The dams up there give electricity to 70,000 homes. They are completely carbon footprint free. They're renewable energy. They are very cheap energy. They're local energy. They're very flexible. In fact, our power grid depends upon dams so that they can add or subtract power generation as needed, because you can do that with dams. And so when you remove your dams, you lose all of that energy. In addition, we forget when you build a dam, that was considered to be progress because rivers can dry up in the summer, and that's true of the Klamath. It actually would get to the point it'd be kind of marshy. There's no fish going to move up that river. And in the wet seasons, they'll flood. And when they flood, they not only do damage to the homes, but in a big flood, I think they had a big one in 67 or something. I mean, boulders as big as a house came down that, and it actually reshapes the river. It changes the shape of the river, the depth of the water. It knocks out the riparian, all the growth on the sides of the river. It destroys all the reds, the fishing nests. They're extremely destructive. They're going to return that kind of condition. In the case of these four dams, the one closest to the ocean is called Iron Gate Dam. It has a fish hatchery. It's responsible for 6.25 million salmon a year that it produces, and it releases into the Klamath River. They're going to take out the fish hatchery. They're against fish hatcheries. They say, well, those aren't real fish. Those are, you know, hatchery fish. Well, if they didn't clip their fins, you wouldn't know whether it's wild or it was a hatchery fish. And they're going to remove that. They're going to release 20-plus million cubic yards of silt that's built up behind these dams over the past 100 years and release that into the river. Well, they did this on the Shasta River with small check dams, and they had a much very smaller amount. And when it went into the Klamath River, it stopped. It settled out. When the water velocity dropped, the sediment drops and formed an infection zone in the river. And this was studied, and one year that it was studied, 100% of the salmon were infected because the silt encourages certain kinds of worms that carry diseases, and these worms get in the gills of the fish and transfer the infection to the fish. Well, the amount of sediment that will be released when these dams go is, you know, I don't know, thousands of times more than that, and they're going to release this into the river. The Klamath River is a very unusual river in that it starts in a kind of a on volcanic land in a more or less an arid desert kind of area in southern Oregon. And the lake is very shallow, about 10 feet deep most of the time. So the lake is very shallow, sits on volcanic rock in a warm area to begin with. So the water is warm and full of phosphates. Now, that is perfect water for farming, perfect water for farming because the phosphates and the warmth also, you know, help plants grow. It unfortunately also helps blue-green algae grow, so the river will, in fact, at times turn green. Well, salmon will die at 61 degrees Fahrenheit and warmer. They really want cold water, like 35 to, you know, 50 degrees is where they kind of thrive. And when water hits 61 degrees, they start dying. And so this river turns out to be extremely poor habitat for the fish up there. And historically, the record doesn't show that they ever existed up there. It appears that coho salmon was not native to this river, but was transplanted there in 1895 from Oregon. And when they did counts of these, of all salmon, not just the coho, but the king salmon, that which is the one that people buy and eat, the one that we're normally familiar with, back in the 1910s and 1920s, about the time these dams were being built, there was only maybe 200 fish this year, 500 next year, you know, that made it, you know, 200 miles upstream. 85% of the salmon actually will spawn within 12 to 22 miles of the coast. So they generally don't travel this far, and they certainly don't travel to this warm, murky water. But anyway, that's the conditions of the water. And then as the river flows to the Pacific Ocean, it actually hits the Pacific Coastal Range and begins to pick up a lot of natural snow melt. So it's cold, it's clear, it's nice, clean water. And the volume of the river can, increases, I think, almost by the time it hits the ocean, if I recall, it's about sevenfold increase in water. So it's picking up a lot of really good water. And so it becomes actually better and better and better water as it goes close to the ocean. So the whole argument to move, you know, knock out four dams 200 miles from the river so that the fish can go five more miles upstream towards warm, murky water is it's crazy to begin with. So, but these are the kind of conditions that these people are dealing with. The regulations are getting to be crazy. The ranchers literally are being told they cannot do anything. They cannot, you know, change the way a ditch works and how they maneuver water. They can't put a rock or a boulder into the flow of the little creek on their property to, you know, alter the way it flows. They can't do anything on their property without getting some kind of a permit or permission to pay money and wait months. Did you say
okay, that? I want to shift a little bit. I'm going to take a risk. I'm going to speak for our listeners in the proverbial we and invite any listener that thinks that disagrees with what I'm saying to call in and to challenge what I'm saying. But what I would like to ask you is to give us some of the reasons that you think this kind of stuff is going on. Why are they doing these things? Okay, now I'm going to open it up with the we, and that is we think that these things are not because these people are stupid, but it's a deliberate agenda serving multiple purposes. Some of it's false flag kind of thing. Some of it's where they create the crisis so that they can take advantage of that crisis. We believe that some of their agenda is extremely sinister and Luciferian, that it comes back down to some of the strange thinking that you were talking about before, about, you know, wanting to control population, thinking of themselves as God, wanting to destroy personal individual rights, wanting to take the production away from the people so that they cannot resist their authoritarian and dictatorial governing so that we can't stop them from squelching and stepping on the Constitution. They actually want to kill people in some instances, that they want to be worshipped as gods, and that by destroying individual personal property rights and even the environment and our agriculture and taking control of our lands, they can own our mineral rights, and that it's all about, it goes beyond wanting to steal and control the wealth all the way to being worshipped like gods. and I'd like to get your feedback on what I just said. Critique it, throw darts at it, agree with it, whatever you want to do.
I agree with 100%. The difficulty for most people, I don't know how informed your audience is, the difficulty is for most Americans who are principally Christian and principally good people, is who themselves do not have any thoughts like that. They cannot comprehend, you know, why anybody would do something like that. That's the biggest single threat to our future is really not these people. It is the inability of the American people to be able to conceive that such people could exist on this planet. But they do. There is a excellent video I've generated. It's only 3.5 minutes long. You can find it on my YouTube channel, where this very topic is discussed in 3.5 minutes. Interview between Alex Jones and who was the producer that did the Aaron Rousseau. I took 3.5 minutes clips from the interview that Aaron Rousseau did with Alex Jones, and I put together 3.5 minutes. All you have to do is watch 3.5 minutes. Invest 3.5 minutes, and you'll understand that what I am saying is true, because Aaron Rousseau is in direct communication with Nick Rockefeller. They are friends, and he knows firsthand that this is their objective.
Right, and this video was just posted within the last 3 or 4 days on Dr. Tate's blog at Dr. Tate's View, WordPress.com. And, I had seen this video some time ago, and I shared with some people, and I'm going to throw this at you. I was at the Tesla conference in Albuquerque just back at the end of July. And one of the gentlemen that I got to visit with there was actually the person who personally helped administer some treatment to Aaron Rousseau for his cancer. And he told me that 1 week before Aaron went into the hospital, 1 week, that he had gone in and been tested for his cancer, and they found that he had no cancer in his body. 1 week before he got ill and went into the hospital and suddenly, quickly died. And it was stated, the official report was, that he died of cancer.
And you're looking for my reaction?
Yeah.
I find it very easy to believe. You know, one of the areas that I studied, I didn't mention it in my list, is assassinations, because once you begin to understand, you know, what kind of happens, you go back and try and reevaluate things. So I went back and reevaluated Kennedy, and actually starting with Andrew Jackson. That was the first assassination attempt. Abraham Lincoln, Garfield, McKinley, you name it. Yeah, and those all tie to the banking legislation. So, you know, the world is being shaped by assassination, and it's, you know, strategic assassination, but you know, there's kind of this layered approach. You know, they ignore you, and then if you make a difference, then they come and do a character or economic assassination. If that isn't good enough, they remove you. And if you, who was the Brown, the secretary under Clinton, that was supposed to, his airplane was supposed to have crash landed in the mountain? Well, that's completely bogus. That was a long time ago. He was about to go public with his stuff. The, you know, things are not what people think, and they are radically different from what people think. The difficulty is spanning, you know, a conversation like this with, you know, an introductory on-ramp kind of a conversation that most people need. And so it really depends upon the audience. If you have an informed audience, then they're ready for this. If they're not, they need the on-ramp. But what you're saying is absolutely true.
Ron Brown, I believe, is who you were referring to.
Ron Brown, you're absolutely correct. That's it.
Well, I indicated that I felt like some of what you were talking about happening in the rural areas, you know, some of it through the Endangered Species Act, you know, they come up with all sorts of excuses to try to take control, especially like you mentioned, Agenda 21, et cetera. a lot of this is false flag and with false information, and they use their owned and controlled media, the propaganda, and I like to call lamestream media rather than mainstream media. One of our guys that's a regular listener put on the chat room here a little bit ago that back in 1972 he beat up his television set with a sledgehammer. but the point is that they put out all of this false information, and then they use this false data to go out and to do these things that seem like they're stupid or that they're incompetent. Well, now we've got this Occupy Wall Street situation. How do you see the bankers using this Occupy Wall Street? You know, we talk here a lot about smoke screens and how the left-right debate basically is a smoke screen. That's one thing I like about your work is that you don't get caught up in that left-right stuff. You just talk about the details, and it doesn't matter which side you're on. If you see the truth, you're gonna figure out that it's all about liberty and it's not about, you know, left and right. This Occupy Wall Street thing, if you look at the list of people who they've now identified that has actually contributing to that or is involved in organizing that, you know, I've seen emails that have been sent to me where Van Jones sent out email blasts encouraging people to participate and to organize, these Occupy Wall Street stuff. We know that George Soros' MoveOn.org is involved. We know that SEIU is involved. But now we're hearing things like the Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran is, supporting this. And we know that the people that organized the Occupy Orlando, for example, were part of the Muslim Brotherhood. To me, it all comes back to these banksters. And I'm just wondering what you know about this and how you see that they're using this. And can you talk about that a little bit? Have you put some thought into that?
Well, I have to profess ignorance of the details because I've been so focused on this event for the past 2 months. I haven't really had time for news. But the little bit I have heard is that it's taking a socialist bent. And if that's the case, it's just being diverted. For whatever reasons it may have started, I mean, the good news is at least targeting the right agencies. They're finally going after the money people, which is good. But to the extent to which it's being directed into then a socialist philosophy, it's definitely being managed and co-opted, no doubt in my mind. The true, real reform here needs to be shut down the Fed, not turn it into continue to support it as a socialist agent, which is what it does. It invents money out of nowhere, and then it distributes it wherever it wants, and generally takes it from the people who have it and redistributes it to themselves and people who don't have it. Understanding history is so valuable because what you begin to realize is that you see that these people have a playbook, and it's the same damn plays. It's just like a football team. They have their 20 plays, and you begin to see the pattern over and over and over again. You know, they'll use a play, then they won't use it for 10 years or 20 years, a decade or two, let a generation come and go, and then they'll reuse it again, and then they won't use it for another decade. You see this over and over again, so there's no doubt in my mind that this has been co-opted. It's reminiscent of how they got the Federal Reserve System passed, where they created a false debate. It made it sound like, the Federal Reserve Act was the people's alternative to the Aldrich plan, the Wall Street plan. They made a play, and they made a kind of a game where the Wall Street people acted like, oh, my God, we can't possibly have that plan. Well, they knew that the political environment in the country at the time is the people wanted something that did not support Wall Street. So when they heard that this dialogue going on, they were convinced that this was the one they wanted because the bankers were so far against it, and that turned out to be a whole fraudulent PR system with people that they hired that were professors to kind of give that whole flavor to it. And, here again you see that happening in global warming, professors coming out and giving you a false testimony and false science. I have a friend that's attended these events. When I was in college in the 60s, I happened to be on campuses during the riots, so I've been in the middle of riots, and I can tell you right now that most of the kids that are standing there are kind of like, this is interesting to do. Take a break from homework. Let me stand here and watch what happens. they're bystanders, and what you have is a few people who are anarchists that are weaving their way in and out of the group of people, and they're the ones that quickly dart out there, run up to the Bank of America, in our case in Santa Barbara, UC Santa Barbara, where I went to school. They throw a rock through the window, and then they disappear, and then in the meantime, the police come in and start bashing heads, and then you have a general problem. But it's a relatively few number of people that work these groups, and then they try and create an event that occurs that turns it into something completely different, and then draws in the rest of the students or people into that. You saw that with the Bolshevik Revolution in St. Petersburg. That's how they did it there as well. So I have no doubt that this thing is being co-opted.
You don't think that it was initiated by them?
I don't know. I just am not close enough to it. No, I wouldn't put it past them. If you study...
Well, let me share my greatest concern. My greatest concern here is that they intend to escalate this. They put these people out there. I don't think the Tea Party or anybody else, or some of these that have been out there, I don't believe any of these people could have organized this to the volume that it escalated to as quick as it did, unless it was organized by the union people. But my concern is that they're going to escalate this to the point of excusing them to install martial law.
Well, I think that they would probably be more than happy to do that. I think they're looking for any reason to do that. There's no question about that, which, by the way, you know, if you study history, you understand that this all goes back to Abraham Lincoln, probably the nation's worst president once you really began to peel back and figure out what happened. But he was the first one to declare the idea that somehow in a state of emergency you can throw away the Constitution. It's constitutional to be unconstitutional. And that whole thing goes back to him. And I have no doubt that they're waiting and ready to either have such an event occur, and I think the Tea Party people have disappointed them, and the Tea Party people are actually just mainstream Americans who are concerned about an unconstitutional government, and nothing ever happened. They even cleaned up their mess when they went to Washington, D.C. So they were probably more than ready to provoke one. I actually forecast several months ago that I expected this would be a hot summer, and I think that's exactly what's happening.
Well, there's a lot of discussion about the fact that we're still have been in a declared state of war for some time, that in fact martial law has been in existence, that we are in fact in an undischarged state of bankruptcy that allows them to basically circumvent the Constitution. Where do you think we are on that?
Well, I understand that line of argument, and I actually have heard what I consider to me to be the most cogent analysis of this that I've come across, and one which I tend to believe at this point in time. And if you take a look at the 13th and 14th Amendments, what you discover is in there the final clause. The 13th Amendment is the one that frees the slaves, and the 14th Amendment has a number of goodies in it, one of which is the inability to go after the bankers for all the debt that's being created. But there's a clause at the very bottom of that, and I forget the exact wording, but more or less it says, these amendments shall be governed by the Congress. And that sounds so logical. That says, oh, yeah, sure. But I think that the body of law that I have seen, and Supreme Court decisions seem to back this up, is that what in fact happened is the federal government, up till this point, the states were sovereign and the citizens of this country were citizens of their sovereign states. They were not citizens of a, quote, federal government. They were citizens of their states. And that what began to happen is the federal government decided that it was going to have its own class of citizenship. Now think about this. Here's this administrative body that has 10 square miles of land that decides that it, too, can have its own citizens. It essentially has declared itself a foreign country. And so there are no question that there are two classes of citizenship. There is your citizenship in your sovereign state, and now there's this federal citizenship that's been created. And that federal citizenship, in my opinion, is governed not by the Constitution, but is governed by civil law. And this is where you get the term civil rights. And this comes from the 13th and 14th Amendment that basically says this class of citizenship is going to be governed by Congress, therefore by law, by legislation, not by the Constitution. And then their task was to somehow pull people into this federal citizenship, which gets you in the whole discussion of birth certificates and, straw men and all those kind of discussions. I actually believe that that is the proper logic. And then once they got us pulled in, the barriers between martial law or, all these different classes of law, commerce law, there's all these classes you can get lost in how many different kinds of law. I think they all just kind of blurred out, and they just started to do whatever they wanted to do. And so clearly there's laws that are being adopted that are martial in nature, or admiralty law. Some people call it admiralty law. I think it all kind of got murky, and it all kind of got thrown into one pile.
Right. I've been involved in so many discussions on admiralty, contract, private courts, corporate courts, it kind of all gets blurry after a while. But you kind of have to understand what the court is established as, and it's very difficult, because if you try to question the judiciary about that, you're gonna find that you're gonna get shut down real quick. They'll either stop the proceeding or whatever they have to do, but they'll actually have you escorted out by the marshals if they have to prevent avoid answering those kind of questions.
Yeah, no, I agree with you.
We've got about a half an hour, and I really would like to get into the details of the financial side of this. You know, I believe you know that I've been a student of Dr. Edwin Vieira for some time. I've studied his sound money bills that have been proposed around the country at many different states that have been copied. You know, they've either used directly his work or copied what he did for New Hampshire. He's now trying to update that. And I look at the possibility of installing a sound money system that will compete with the Federal Reserve. It was like you said earlier, you can't just go in and dump that system. It's not that simple. But to put a competing system into place, which is sort of what I'm hearing Ron Paul talk about. I don't know if he has exactly the same thing in mind. It's something I want to have further discussion with him about. But I'm wondering how you see this coming down. What do you think is possible? I also believe that we've got a better chance of seeing something happen on a state-by-state basis than we do at the federal level. And I also believe that we need a barrier put up at the state level to protect the individual from the federal tyranny. So I'm kind of curious to hear how you see that model working and how you see it being enacted, what's possible, and how it needs to happen in order for it to really be effective.
Well, I think that in my opinion, it's a two-step process. I mean, the ultimate thing you have to do is constrain the money supply so that the money supply doesn't grow faster than real wealth. And so the question is, what's the appropriate constraint, whether you constrain it by saying it's either gold or silver, or you constrain it by some other method. So it actually turns out to be multiple methods to think about. But I tend to believe that you can't jump to that immediately. We can't just automatically go to a constrained money system. So let's say, for example, that you said that, Federal Reserve notes are out and the only money tomorrow is gold and silver. Well, where does that leave us? I mean, nobody has it. The federal government sure doesn't have it. So nobody has any of it to pay their bills with. And where do you get it and how do you buy it? What do? Go in more debt to go ahead and get a gold and silver currency? So I think, in my opinion, it's unrealistic to jump into that right away. I think that the hole that we're in debt-wise is so deep that we're not going to be able to do that. So I think that, for me, even before you talk about the total solutions, is what is the objective? So in my opinion, when you want to change this monetary system, what is it you're trying to achieve? So first off, you're trying to take the power away from the guys that have grabbed it unto themselves, and you're supposed to, and do it in a way that re-empowers the people and their wealth and prosperity. To do that, you've got to get rid of the debt. And I think that the debt at the federal level and at the individual level have to both be removed. And within 10 years, that would be my target. And I think that's actually achievable to do. So you want to eliminate the debt and leave this country back in a debt-free status, and then I think you're in a position to reinstall a more constrained type of monetary supply. So how do you accomplish those things? And you have to do it in a way that, in my view, others have different views, but my view is you can't crash the economy and you can't just crash people. I may not like the fact that union people get the kind of benefits that they do, but you know, they got a contract and they went into it with that contract, and I think we ought to honor that. I think we ought to honor the Social Security beneficiaries, the Medicare beneficiaries, people who pay for it. So I think that there has to be a way to be able to have enough money to actually meet these obligations without just, you know, having 50 million people starve to death. And for my opinion, the one way to do that is you go back and you unwind this thing. And the next step backwards is you have to go back to legal tender notes or United States notes. These could be printed, and I would eliminate Federal Reserve notes and I would start printing legal tender notes. And the difference for your audience is that Federal Reserve notes are actually bank notes. The government prints them, gives them to the cost of printing to the Federal Reserve, and then borrows them back at full face value. So how would you like to be in a business where you have a cost of a nickel, and all of a sudden you get $100 bill that you can lend out? That's how this monetary system works. And so the government is essentially borrowing its own credit. I mean, it's crazy, and putting us into debt. So what you do instead is you go back to legal tender notes. And this is a currency that can be issued in circulation without going through a banking system, which is where all this debt gets created. And it can start to pay its bills. It can go ahead and pay its wages. It can pay its military wages. It can pay Social Security benefits, its Medicare, Medicaid benefits, food stamps. If we're going to continue to do that to some level, you could eliminate those credit cards that have been given and do that. More importantly, you can use that kind of currency to actually start paying down these debts. I mean, the bankers have been giving us their paper for these years. Let's give the bankers back, paper that we print. So I would print out, massive amounts of paper and give them to the banks. So there, we just paid off all these debts. Or either default on them and say, hey, this is fraud to begin with, and we'll default on them. They could also use those to go ahead and buy gold and silver and start to restock the treasury. Another way I would use them is what I call the Jubilee Decade, and that is to help you get the people out of debt. So most people are, when home mortgages started, they were 10-year simple interest fixed-term loans. And it was FDR that moved them to be 30-year, and then later on they came with variable interest rate, which essentially means that you pay the banks control how much they take from you each month to live in your own home. And all these changes have been implemented in the system. We need to get rid of that debt. So I think another way to do this is that the federal government could, in fact, step in as a buyer of these existing mortgages and replace them. If it, on a voluntary basis, whatever homeowner wants to go with this program could have the option of having the government buy their mortgage and then give them a new mortgage. And that new mortgage would be a simple interest 0.5% loan. 0.5%. That's more than enough to service the loan. Now, it's not meant to be a gift or a handout. If you don't pay off, you still go through foreclosure and whatever else. But it's enough to fund the current system, the current banks, the current mortgage systems, the current debt collectors, the whole system will continue to function with the people and rules that are already in place. But everybody will be out of debt within 10 years. And probably with the monthly payment that would be less, no more than what they're already paying, and almost all of it will go to principal, and almost zero goes to interest. That, to me, is the Jubilee Decade. And so now, within 10 years, we have the federal government out of debt, we have the people out of debt, we're basically a free people again, and I would return in that process a loyal title. I mean, to say that somehow property can be divided and mineral rights go over to here, or air rights go over to there, or these rights go over to there, heck no. You know, you have a loyal title of property, and once people have, they're not paying a landlord for their monthly subsistence or home, and they actually own their own property, it's amazing how your whole financial system and outlook on life turn around. All of a sudden, you've got money. It's amazing. If you're debt-free, it's a different world, and it's a world of liberty. And so I personally would go through an approach like that, and then I would look at the alternative ways to then go to the phase two, which is a constrained money supply. And I'm particularly attracted to the notion that what is money actually needed for? And if you really analyze it, what money is needed for is for a transaction. And particularly it's needed for a timed transaction where, say, you want to buy something. You're a company here in the United States, a distributor, and you want to buy something from a manufacturer in Taiwan. Well, the Taiwan guy says, hey, I want to make sure you got the money to pay me. And you say, hey, I want to make sure you got the goods. You know, the bankers get in the middle and put out a letter of intent. Essentially, it's a kind of a guarantee. But the way that works is the buyer actually puts the money in the bank. It's so it's not any risk for the bank. But what you really need is a certain amount of money to finance a transaction, and you only need it for a short period of time. Well, then why not create and extinguish money as needed to support transactions? Why not be a transaction-based money? I think that's kind of appealing to me. You could also monetize money out of people's labors and, you know, allow farmers to use their products for money or convert them into money. There's lots of ways to skin the cat, but gold and silver I'm skeptical of, because unless the world moves to gold and silver, the history is very clear. The good money will be hoarded and the bad money will be spent, and it'll go into circulation. And so if we're on a gold and silver standard and nobody else is, you can expect to see a lot of gold and silver disappear from this country and flow out. And guess what? We won't have a money supply again. So I tend to believe we need to look at beyond just gold and silver. Now, if we're going to look to a metal, I would choose silver first and foremost. It is the people's money. It always has been. A dollar is 371 and a quarter grains of pure silver mixed 90%, 10% with copper. That's what a silver dollar is. Today, a dollar at current prices buys you about $32. So I can take a silver dollar today, and I can still buy a meal for a family of four or three or four, or take the whole family out for the movies. In other words, prices when you start to use the money like silver are actually still what they used to be for in your granddad's day, because that silver really hasn't lost value. It's still constant. You can still buy a cup of coffee for a dime. You can still go out and do things for 15 cents. A gallon of gasoline is probably about 15 cents or so. I'd go to silver first and foremost. A dollar, the definition of a dollar is a silver dollar. Gold has always been the metal for the rich, because it's too expensive for daily transactions. It's the money that people hoard when you have a lot of wealth. I would base the currency on silver, and maybe silver alone.
Well, a couple of things that I've come to believe are critical. One is that the people have proprietary ownership of whatever that rare commodity is. And I believe that we live in a digital age, and that one of the ways that we can transfer even gold is on a digital basis, so that you can break it down into small enough fractions that you can actually transact in electronic gold transfer even in smaller proportions than with silver. Point is, either silver or gold would work. I believe that the electronic transfer cannot be associated with any bank or ownership of the medium of exchange, that the ownership of that has to be with the people or with the government, whichever it is. It depends on whose hand it's in at the time. But we've got to have a way of forcing it into circulation. And the only way to do that is to get the government you know, requiring some tax, for example, let's say tobacco tax in this case, to start out and to compete with the existing paper system. The other thing that I found that is really critical is that we cannot allow banks to control the issue of the money. They cannot create money out of thin air the way they are with our fractional reserve system right now. Would you continue with what you described? Would the paper continue to be handled on a fractional reserve basis, or would you change that to some kind of bailment system?
I'd probably turn it over to a system where it would be fractional, but it would, the fraction would be less and less and less. That's kind of my idea. The, all of these things, what you find is that if you have immoral people, there's no security in any of these approaches. You know, if, for example, you decided to go ahead and issue electronic credits against gold being stored somewhere by whom? You know, how do you know that they actually have the amount on store? How do you know they haven't actually embezzled and, you know, or gone to fractional reserves and you don't even realize it and done exactly what is done historically? I mean, when you understand the history of money, that's what they did. I mean, they were supposed to store the gold, but guess what? They either lent it out or they actually kept it, but then they started creating, you know, false paper claims on the same gold, which is what you can do electronically. So, it you know, it still gets back to a real problem of how do you, what kind of a system do you come to? The only system I know where it should become self-regulating is if you tie it to the actual transactions.
Well, I, as I recall, I don't know if you have looked into that actual sound money legislation as it was, as it's been proposed. Have you actually studied Vieira's work on that or not?
No, not in depth. I did know, was it Utah that recently passed a kind of a silver money deal?
They took all of the teeth out of it. It started out as typical of the sound money legislation that had been proposed, starting in New Hampshire and Montana, Colorado, you know, like I guess it was 12 or 13 different states that tried to get it through, and it all got shut down and committee along party lines. But in Utah, what happened was when they realized that it was going to go down in committee, just like it has everywhere else, they took the teeth out of it. They didn't make it where any taxes would be collected that way. They didn't make it so that it would be forced into circulation. They didn't make it a competing system. All they did was they ended up authorizing the use of gold and silver as legal tender, and that's all they did. So all of the things, the mechanisms to force it into circulation and to actually make it a competing system, they ripped the guts out of that bill before it got passed.
Well, I think that the silver is a good idea, but I'll tell you a more fundamental problem. I don't know what the detailed approach to this is, but a more fundamental problem to me is if you denominate it in dollars, you've already lost. Because if you have paper
right.
circulation at the same time, that ratio is going to be constantly fluctuating, as we know. And so what happens is, you know, it used to be a dime was worth a nickel in silver, but then that became 6 cents, 7 cents, and eventually got to be worth, you know, 10, 11, 12 cents in terms of paper, and people started to, you know, hoard the silver coins and take them out of circulation. So they have to be denominated in ounces. And if that's the case, then, well, there's no prohibition against you getting them right now. You can go down to your coin dealer and get silver currency and denominated in ounces. Why aren't people doing it?
Exactly. Go ahead.
Well, I think if you start from the tax end of this, it's saying this is one thing I would like to see is that all capital gains be calculated on the basis of a silver or gold constant dollar, whether you own it in gold or not. It should be measured in gold or silver, you know, pick one, and or the better of the two, and that immediately eliminates most of capital gains, and in fact, it's going to turn a lot of people's gains into losses and give them tax breaks. I would immediately do that. I would make all gold and silver transactions, you know, when you do use silver and gold coins, they are intrinsically tax-free because they don't change in their value in the view that I would have where that's the value of the standard of value. So I think there's some things that could be done that would be really meaningful that doesn't necessarily rely upon the circulation as much as some of these kind of considerations.
Well, see, my major thing, and the reason I bring up the things that I did about the proprietary ownership being with the people, et cetera, is that I believe we've got to break the banking vortex. That, and you essentially said that in one of your earlier statements in this show, was basically taking it away from those who are currently controlling it and stealing from us.
Right.
And so that vortex has been created first by giving them the right to control the issue and the amount of our currency, but also then the system where they're basically lending our government the government's own credit and getting interest on it, and that interest is tax free. So that is that's an absolute fraudulent debt. So one objection that I would have, for example, is that we would print government issue currency and use that to pay them, because I think we should pay them with exactly what intrinsic value they put into it in the first place.
Yeah, which is legal tender notes. That's what I'm saying. Print legal tender notes and use them to retire debt. And the other thing is, I mean, pay attention. Oh, wait, I'm sure you did. Ron Paul's proposal, well, if we own the Fed, then let's go, and the Fed owns a lot of our U.S. debt, let's just cancel the Fed debt since we owe it to ourselves.
Exactly.
That's the same thing as issuing a bunch of legal tender notes. Do that.
Right.
Immediately.
Right. I agree with that.
Yeah. I believe the states can do more, and I think that I applaud Vieira's approaches in trying to work with state legislatures to skin the bear at that point. Ultimately, I think we have to put in a president like Ron Paul in order to get this thing turned around completely.
How do you see that happening now? How can we get that to actually happen now?
You know,
for quite some time, I wasn't a great big Ron Paul fan because I didn't have the understanding. It's like you said, we've got to change our understanding of what's going on in the world. And when you start to look at the reasons behind all of the wars that we've been in since the Revolutionary War, if you look at the fact that they've all been created by these banksters, that they've been financed on both sides by these banksters, that in fact most of what we were told about each one of these wars was a lie, and in some cases they even rewrote the history a year or two after the war was over so that they could justify that war and justify future wars. And you also look at the War of Terror, that they deliberately created it without a specific enemy so that it could be perpetual. When you start to look at the fact that they've used wars, for example, to wipe out the Orthodox and Protestant churches in Russia and then in Western and Eastern and Northern Germany, and now even here in the United States. When you start to look at all of this, and I'm a peace through strength guy. I believe that we need a strong military in order to be at peace in this country and in the world. And there has to be some sensible strength somewhere to shut down petty tyrants around the world. So I'm a peace through strength guy. I'm not a pacifist. But I agree with Ron Paul now because my understanding of things has changed from where it was 10 years ago. And a lot of people see him as an isolationist. And that's not a correct view of Ron Paul. He believes in defense. I believe he'll help a friend if he sees a friend around the world really needs our help and ask for it. But what he's not going to do is he's not going to buy into the lies and the propaganda that we've been fed on every war we've been in since this country started. So that message has got to be made clear to people, because I believe that's a critical reason why many conservatives, or I should say Second Amendment Democrats, Thomas Jefferson Democrats, and independents and libertarians, the ones that do not support him, that is the number one reason that I run up against, is that they see him as an isolationist and they see him as weak. And I no longer see him that way on either one of those counts.
I tell you what, you and I are in perfect harmony. It has to start with an awakening of the people. I tell you what, if we got, I don't know, 3 to 5% of the voting population to shut off the TVs for the next week and watch why we're in so much debt, we'd be back on our path to liberty. It's just that simple. Because, you know, I've read a lot of books. I've read a whole ton of them on the monetary system, and they never were simple enough for me. They never quite explained things clearly. And, Frank, you know, there's missing things for me at all times. If I felt the books out there and the stuff out there had satisfied my quest, I wouldn't be writing a book. But that book and the related videos to it provide the on-ramp in the topic and then the depth of the topic in simple terms. If I knew how to, this is why I did it all. It's all out there for, you know, video, YouTube videos are free. You know, if I had the money, I'd be out there at all these rallies handing out, you know, DVDs of my, you know, Why We're in So Much Debt series. But that's quite 3% of the voting population watches that. We would be back on the path within 1 week. Just that.
You think just 3%? I know that 3% fought the Revolutionary War, and I know that only a third of the people really supported it, and about 7% of them actually physically supported it, whether they were sewing uniforms or creating weapons or whatever they were doing, not necessarily in the front line. We've got a caller, and we've got about 9 minutes left, are you willing to take a call?
Sure.
Area code 724, you have a live mic.
Hi, Kurt. I have a question. I'd like to maybe take you back into a personal level. And some of us are aware of the fact that a lot of individuals are losing their behinds in this country. There's also the question that a lot of us also understand that there's been some, shall we say, shady characters out there with groups like RAF, Tim Turner's organization and whatnot. I have a question for you. Have you seen anyone that's been able to successfully or even halfway efficiently sell their bonds or let's say, trade their bonds out and get back some cash?
Trade their bonds out?
Yeah, do the bond issue situation.
Oh, bonds, and get the cash back? I don't watch the bond market that much. I mean, I don't look at this as trying to use all this stuff to figure out how to play the market. If I did, I'd be a lot wealthier. If I figured out how to get our country back, so I really don't watch the market. But, the bonds are, that is, you know, the word bondage comes from bond, right? So the bond holders are the landlords and everybody else is the serf. So those people will definitely keep their bonds, and they'll figure out how to make those bonds earn. You know, they may change a little volume here and there, but ultimately they're holding them.
Kirk, I should introduce you. This is Dwayne Moore. He's a regular here at Walls in Our Minds, and welcome, Dwayne.
Oh, thank you, Terry, and thank you very much. And
any other question or comment for Kirk? We've got about 6 minutes left.
No, thanks for all your help, Kirk. You've been a wonderful inspiration across the country.
Well, Dwayne, thank you very much. I feel like I'm kind of isolated with my computer sometimes. It's good to hear some feedback. But I know the word's getting out there because I can, if nothing else, I can watch my YouTube views. I'm not a sophisticated enough website designer to know how many views are coming to my website, but I can count the YouTube views, and I know that the word's getting out, and I know that my newsletters are now being kind of informally syndicated. I know that there's at least 20 people that are reforwarding those, and so I know it's getting out there, and I'm glad to do what I can do.
Kurt, early in the conversation, you mentioned people's moral compass, I believe was a term you used. Dwayne is actually a pastor, and Dwayne helps us be mindful of the importance of divine providence in this process. And I'm wondering, Kurt, if you would like to elaborate on what you meant by that.
Yeah, Dwayne, actually, I encourage you to watch How to Take Our Country Back Part 2, because you're going to find something in there you wouldn't expect. And it does address this whole issue of the moral compass. And I will approach this, I'll try and approach this in a way that you don't have to be a Christian to go along with this concept. But in essence, the war is between a certain set of values, and there's fewer than 10 values on each side. And on the side of the people like ourselves that are reacting to what's happening, I think I can kind of summarize some of those values. I mean, there is a God, and there is right and wrong. And the definition of what is right is doing good for your fellow man. And there is a judgment day. And there is a belief that the doing those values is more important than money, if you will. There is a belief that you have an individual relationship with God. We're made in God's image, and we have an individual relationship with God. Well, that individual relationship with God leads us into the whole belief in our liberty and equality, you know, that we are equal. If we have a relationship with God directly and our judgment is with God directly, then forget about inherited and collective guilt. Also forget about inherited and collective privileges. Those are out the window. And I think that what Christ brought to this world was the message that if you do God's work, then ye shall be as the sons of Abraham. In other words, everybody is entitled to the covenant. So there are all of us are God's children, and that we all have salvation, and that's all possible. And I believe that there's a radically different view. That view is that there is no God, therefore there is no good or bad. It's might makes right, survival of the fittest, there is no, if you believe that we're made in God's image, you know, then you believe in the sanctity of life. You therefore believe in babies have a right to live. If you don't, then you don't see any particular value in human beings. Therefore, fish are as important as humans, if not more so. Babies aren't important at all. If there's too many of them, we'll let more of them die. you basically come up with two very radical different views of the world. And in my view, the one that is driving us is a Christian heritage that this country began with. And the idea, I think, that was expressed by Christ is the genesis behind the idea that all men are created equal. And I personally believe that it's not necessarily his miracles or his divine, coming back out of dying. I don't believe that those are really what, here's a man who was a carpenter, humble carpenter, at age 30. He doesn't begin preaching until age 30, and he's brutally murdered 3 years later. In 3 years, this man changes the world in a way that endures for 2,000 years. I believe that the very thing that made that enduring was not all of these other stories. It was the idea, which in modern terms has been expressed by the founding fathers, and the concept that all men are created equal. I don't think we understand just how revolutionary and empowering that concept is. And once you begin to understand, reevaluate your own moral bearings, then you can see how that leads into our thinking processes and what we want as an objective and how we see government fitting into this versus the human being and the individual. And therefore, once you understand that, then you understand how the world is different from where we need to be. And then you start having to think about, okay, well, how do I get from here to here? That's the strategy. And then you think, okay, I know where I want to go. But I still need to know how to drive a car. That's where the tactics come in. So I think you're going to find that particular video to be more interesting than you might have thought.
I'll definitely check it out.
Thank you. That was a great explanation. And just within the time period we had, too, we've got about 1 minute left. And I want to come back to this show that we're going to plan together, Kurt, because I think that is extremely important, and I want to move forward with that immediately. So I will be in touch with you, and I really appreciate you coming on. And we went straight through tonight without a break, and you held up great for that. And I haven't heard any complaints, so maybe I'll hear about it later. But you've done a great job. You've been a great guest, and you've fulfilled all of my expectations. And I just want to thank you very much for joining us. I believe we are we are just about out of time here. And is there any final 30-second comment you'd like to make, Kurt?
Terry, you know, people like you are just great, you know, trying to get the word out there and doing what you can do, you know, magnifying that. I appreciate the opportunity to come on your show. I appreciate your thoughts and listening to you because you clearly do understand a lot. You've been thinking about this, too. So it's thoroughly enjoyable for me.
Well, thank you very much. And everyone, we'll be back next Thursday night with Walls in Our Minds. And, Kurt, I'll be in touch, and we'll plan that show right away.
Okay. Good night.
Good night, Dwayne. Good night, Kate.
You stood before.